Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, electric and gas bills could soon spike for thousands of upstate New Yorkers again. NYSEG and RG&E say it's all about keeping the lights on, but critics call it corporate greed. We'll talk to reporter Liam Mayo of the River Reporter about what's behind the proposed rate hikes, what the state audit revealed, and what it all means for your next bill. One in five children in Sullivan County struggle with hunger. The local nonprofit A Single Bite is stepping up, but with major cuts to federal nutrition programs just signed into law, will their efforts be enough? Kimberly Izar speaks with A Single Bite about the growing need and what's at stake. Plus, our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, with science stories this week, and help for artists struggling to get their arts noticed. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. It's a race against the clock to find missing survivors of the devastating flash flooding in Texas. Hope is fading at the same time. Today is day five of the search through remaining floodwaters and masses of wreckage and debris. The death toll has surpassed 100 people. Most victims were in Kerr County. Many are now asking questions about whether the mass casualties could have been prevented. Officials in Texas are expected to give an update in about an hour. Stocks open mixed this morning as President Trump postpones his tariff deadline. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 40 points in early trading.
Stocks were higher overnight in both Japan and South Korea, despite President Trump's threat to hit exports from those countries with 25% tariffs. Trump pushed back the effective date for those import taxes until August 1st, suggesting there's still some room for negotiation. Cargo traffic in the Red Sea is once again coming under attack by Houthi rebels from Yemen. The Houthis sank one vessel Sunday and have now attacked a second ship. The risk of attack has forced some shipping companies to avoid the Red Sea shortcut between Asia and Europe, instead taking the long way around the southern tip of Africa. And Wendy's CEO Kirk Tanner is going from square burgers to rectangular chocolate bars. Tanner takes over as Hershey's CEO next month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump now says the U.S. will send more weapons to Ukraine.
We're going to send some more weapons. We have to. They have to be able to defend themselves. They're getting hit very hard now.
The president made the statement at the White House yesterday, days after the Pentagon halted shipments. He also reiterated his disappointment in Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two spoke last week about Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, now in its fourth year. Both sides continue to trade frequent attacks. Los Angeles officials are condemning the sudden appearance of federal immigration agents at a downtown park Monday. Steve Futterman has details.
It happened in the late morning. Dozens of federal immigration agents, some of them heavily armed, some in armored vehicles, others on horseback, suddenly swept into MacArthur Park in the heart of LA's immigration population. Mayor Karen Bass immediately showed up. After around an hour, the agents left. Bass blasted what she called an act of intimidation.
It's to say to immigrants that they need to stay home. They shouldn't go to work. They shouldn't go to school. Because we're coming after you.
Among those in the park, according to the mayor, was a group of children attending summer camp. On Fox News, a Customs and Border Patrol chief, Gregory Bovino, said LA should get used to this because it's going to, quote, be normal very soon. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
This is NPR. In Spain, the annual festival of San Fermín is underway, in which the centuries-old tradition of running with the bulls takes place. Miguel Macias reports on the second day of festivities.
Only a few seconds go by between that sound and this sound. That's the daily noise that kicks off the Running with the Bulls ritual every morning during the 9 days of the San Fermín Festival in Pamplona, Spain. If you've never seen a so-called encierro, picture this. At 8 a.m. local time, the gates open for half a dozen bulls to be released on the narrow streets and make their way to the bullfighting arena, usually in under 3 minutes. On the streets, hundreds of people run in front of the bulls, sometimes amongst the bulls, in what can be a very dangerous adventure. But today, a bull named Caminante, or Walker, weighing more than 1,200 pounds, took more than 5 minutes to arrive. In the end, one person was gored and taken to the hospital. He's in a stable condition. Miguel Macias, NPR News, Seville, Spain.
Sean Diddy Combs is expected to appear for a virtual hearing today to discuss when he'll be sentenced. His attorneys and the prosecution want to expedite the timeline. The judge originally set sentencing for October 3rd. A jury found the music mogul guilty of transportation to engage in prostitution last week. He was acquitted of racketeering and sex trafficking. The American Academy of Pediatrics and several public health organizations are suing Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. over his decision to stop recommending COVID-19 vaccinations for healthy children and pregnant women. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and I'm joined in the studio by Mimi Bradley, our development manager. Hi.
Good morning. How are you?
Happy Fun Drive Day 2. I'm good.
I'm good, too. We are less than $250 away from $5,000.
That's amazing.
So I know.
That would be over 10% of our $55,000 goal, I think.
Yeah.
Or something like
something,
that.
Something
I don't
like
do
that.
The math.
We're close. I know. Yeah. The computer does.
The computer does it. But we have a way to get us a little bit closer there through a challenge that was issued by one of our great listeners.
We do. Our friend Roger from Koneyanga Lake has challenged $250.
Hey, Roger, thank you so much for that. You can help us with this challenge. All you have to do is call us at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org and make a donation of any amount toward that challenge. The way it works is it's a matching challenge. We'll get the $250 from Roger. If we raise the $250, and then boom, that becomes the $500, and then the computer does that math thing.
Yay! And then we're over $5,000. We're in a strong place for day two. I have to say thank you to everyone who's donated. For those who haven't yet, please do.
Yeah, 845-482-4141, wjffradio.org. It's our summer fun drive, and asking for your support. We're listener-supported public radio. We rely on you for the majority of our funding. You may have heard about some of the threats to our federal funding. That is real. It represents about 25% of our budget. It's not insignificant, but we're focused on the listeners and you and staying here to provide you with the local news and culture and everything that you come to rely on from this station for the last 35 years. And as I've said since the beginning, we're not going anywhere,
no
matter what happens in Washington. But we do need your help to stay here. So please donate at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. Help us meet this $250 generous challenge from Roger in Koneyanga Lake.
I forgot the most important part.
What's that part? Thank you. Thank you. That is the most important part. Thank you for donating. And Mimi's going to take your call if you want to call us now, 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. Now, upstate New Yorkers may soon face another hit to their wallets. New York State Electric and Gas, or NYSEG, along with Rochester Gas and Electric, or RG&E, both subsidiaries of Avangrid, are proposing steep rate hikes that could raise monthly bills by more than 30% for some customers. The companies say the increases are necessary to cover aging infrastructure, regulatory changes, and looming financial pressures. But critics, including some state lawmakers and consumer advocates, are calling the proposal excessive and pointing to a recent audit that found serious flaws in how the companies are managed. To help us unpack what's driving this rate hike request is Liam Mayo, reporter for the River Reporter, who's been reporting on this developing story. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Give us the big picture here, the takeaway from this NYSEG and RG&E latest rate hike proposal.
Yeah, I think the big picture is the companies are requesting increased rates at a time when they are already facing a lot of criticism and a lot of heat for the level that the rates currently are at. We were reporting earlier in the year on complaints from residents about soaring bills, and a lot of what we found, or a lot of what people were saying about why bills were increasing over the winter, was unrelated to sort of these specific rate increases. The last rate change happened a couple of years back, I believe in 2021, but don't quote me on that. I'm just doing that from memory. So a lot of the increases that people were seeing over the winter were sort of fluctuating things. It was weather. It was sort of a colder winter than expected. And that is sort of one part of the rate increases, but the electricity bill increases that people are seeing. But the other half of it is the delivery rates that get set by the utilities like NYSEG and RG&E. And that part of it now is what NYSEG and RG&E are requesting to increase again. They've requested sort of an increase over a one-year period from 26 to 27 of, like you said, up to or a little bit over 30% on an average resident's monthly bills. Just to put some more numbers into what that looks like, according to NYSEG, the average quote-unquote utility customer or the average NYSEG electric customer currently is paying around $139 a month for their electric bills. That would go up to $172, a 23.7% increase. And the other increases are from around 22-23% up to 33%.
And we've just come from this winter where we saw a lot of folks saw these spikes in their electricity bills, and now another proposed rate hike here, which would cause more of an increase here. What is the company saying to, I guess, justify this? They're arguing they're necessary and unavoidable. What are the reasons they're giving for needing such steep hikes?
Yeah, the reasons they're giving, it's a little bit of a grab bag. The phrase, everything and the kitchen sink, comes to mind. They claim that there are legacy issues with aging infrastructure that needs to be upgraded. They're sort of pointing to certain regulatory changes that they need to put money into addressing. They are point to sort of their credit metrics, basically saying that their financial situation right now makes it hard to go out and borrow the money that they need to fund needed improvements to their utility infrastructure. A quote they have is, in the end, the company's requested rate increases are necessary and unavoidable, with a large portion due to legacy issues and other factors beyond the company's control. But that's kind of a claim that has come under a lot of skepticism from both the general public and from elected officials and from people who've audited the company. This most recent rate increase has already kind of been slammed by a broad range of elected officials. Governor Kathy Hochul put out a statement saying, quote, at a time when New Yorkers are struggling to meet everyday costs, NYSEG and RG&E must find a way to avoid these unacceptably high rate hikes. I am calling on the Department of Public Service to scrutinize these proposals to ensure these companies have the resources to keep our energy grid going, but are not making additional profit off the backs of ratepayers. And that scrutiny is something the PSC or the Public Service Commission has been doing. There's an audit that their consultants did and was concluded back in February. It has sort of more recently been released to the public. And what that audit claimed is sort of that the company is making additional profit off the backs of ratepayers. The audit pointed to the corporate structure of NYSEG and RG&E, where both companies are subsidiaries of this bigger company, Avangrid. And what it said was a lot of the decisions about where to put resources throughout that entire company aren't being made by NYSEG and RG&E. So the companies aren't sort of making their own decisions about infrastructure upgrades or where to put their resources. A lot of those decisions are being made at the broader, at the higher level, the Avangrid level, and essentially are prioritizing corporate profits over the good of New Yorkers. This is a direct quote from that audit. Avangrid prioritizes corporate earnings, not the needs of NYSEG and RG&E. So even though they're like NYSEG and RG&E are making all of these claims as to like why they need the rate increases that they need and why those rate increases are unavoidable and outside of their control, the prevailing sentiment among elected officials, auditors, everybody is kind of just skepticism about how out of control these things are.
Yeah, and even Representative Josh Riley, who represents New York's 19th congressional district, came out with some pretty harsh language for the company, saying, quote, "This rate increase is a slap in the face, and I'm going to fight it with everything I've got." Even went as far as to say that it's a foreign-owned utility monopoly that's raking in massive profits while failing over 100 basic operational functions. Pretty harsh words from him and all the other elected officials as well. Senator Peter Overrocker calling it, quote, it's a pattern of abuse, and it's time they're held accountable. Are you surprised by the outcry from the public officials?
No, honestly. It just feels like a very, I mean, obviously these things like are, the rate increases come at on a several year time frame. So the last rate increase or the last rates were set sort of to expire, at such a time that NYSEG does now need to come out with its request for what it wants the next rates to be. So it, the timing is a little bit outside of, NYSEG or RG&E's control, but there has just been sort of months of calls for NYSEG and RG&E to look at their rates and to either sort of scrutinize the upcoming rate increases like this would be, or to pull back rate increases that had already come. So the idea that NYSEG and RG&E is just going to make this additional request for more rate increases on top of what it has already done, it almost feels a little tone deaf. There was a the company had a response filed to the audit that I found a little bit amusing, where they say, sorry, I'm just trying to find the exact quote. It claimed the final audit report presents, quote, an overwhelmingly negative tone, and it was complaining about that. And I wonder if, like, NYSEG and RG&E are really surprised that people are reacting negatively toward this or reacting negatively toward their operations right now when there's already this negative sentiment and this like belief in the community and among elected officials that their rates are already too high.
Well, yeah, and over the winter, as we mentioned, folks saw significant spikes in their bills all across the state from these utilities. And also in June, Senator Oberrocker called for a full investigation into the practices of utilities like NYSEG and calling for mandatory and fully itemized utility bills. So it is surprising that they're surprised in some ways. What's next in this process? They've requested this rate hike. What happens next?
Yeah, so next in this process, the way it works is NYSEG and RG&E request rate increases, and then it's up to the Public Service Commission to review whether they believe what the company is saying and whether those rate increases are appropriate. That's sort of why we're hearing the calls to PSC to evaluate these rate increases. In addition to sort of the ones we've already mentioned, there was a, the Sullivan County Legislature passed a resolution urging the PSC to scrutinize proposed delivery rates in the future, not just for NYSEG, but also other utilities in the area. So they're another sort of voice that has previously weighed in on this. So the PSC will be working with NYSEG and RG&E, and I imagine hearing a lot from the public. I don't have sort of the specifics in front of me right now, but I believe there are ways to submit public comment to the PSC as part of this process. They'll definitely be hearing from regulators as this process goes through. And ultimately, I think what we'll see is probably a compromise of some sort. That's generally, I believe, what happens is the final rate increase allowed is lower than the rate increase requested. NYSEG and RG&E in their filings basically said, like, hey, we're filing a one-year rate increase proposal, but we'd love to work with you, the PSC, on planning out a 5-year rate increase so that we can have a little bit more stability. So there's already kind of the door open for those conversations, but I think the question will just be, how much of a compromise is it? Is that going to favor the utilities, or is that going to favor kind of the rate paying or the paying members of the public?
Yeah, and again, to be clear, it's a 1-year rate proposal covering May 1st, 2026 to April 30th, 2027. That is the proposal. It will go through this process. And also, it's not just NYSEG and RG&E, other utilities like Central Hudson and Orange and Rockland also proposing increases and also under scrutiny. Leah Mayo from the River Reporter covering this story that affects folks' pocketbooks. I'm sure you'll stay on it, and we'll be talking to you again. Before we go, though, I wanted to just ask you about our partnership here. You're one of our great partners at the River Reporter. We're able to bring you the great news that you cover in the area here on our radio station. Thanks to listeners who support us as well during our summer fun drive. Talk a little bit about how, you know, that's helpful for you guys, too, to be able to bring your stories out in this broader way to this listener base through listener support.
Yeah, it's incredibly helpful. It's incredibly helpful to be able to find a wider audience for our reporting. It's incredibly helpful to be able to talk about these stories over the air in ways that we don't, you know, get to in the printed dead tree paper versions of the newspaper. But it's also just really important, I think, to have colleagues in the community. Like, any one newspaper, any one organization can only cover so much. And especially with sort of the reporting that you guys are doing nowadays, like, having Radio Catskill healthy, having Radio Catskill, like, fully supported by the community is really more important now than ever.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people to, you know, give whatever they're comfortable with. If you care about this coverage, if you care about our coverage, if you care about the great coverage that you get from Radio Catskill every day, it's kind of on you to support it. So,
well, please do it. 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. And please continue to read the River Reporter, whether that's on Dead Tree Stock or online at riverreporter.com. Leah Mayo, thank you so much. It's also great to get to hear the name behind the byline, and folks get to hear your talk about your reporting and the great work that you're doing there and bringing these stories to life for us. So thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next Tuesday.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Again, it's our summer fun drive. We have a challenge here from Roger in Conneaugh Lake. He's challenged listeners to raise $250. And if we can raise the $250, we'll get that $250. That makes it $500. Call us 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. Make a donation of any amount. We'll take a quick break, and we'll get an update on where we are with those donations and that challenge. Plus, we'll hear more about hunger in Sullivan County. The local nonprofit A Single Bite is stepping up, but with major cuts to federal programs signed into law, will their efforts be enough? We'll talk to them after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Bill Williams. Join me tonight for a special fun drive edition of the Kingfisher Project. My guest will be Dr. Arthur Robin Williams, Chief Medical Officer for Ophelia Health, a telehealth initiative focusing on substance abuse. And I will be live in the studio to ask for your support during Radio Catskill's Fun Drive. Listen to the Kingfisher Project tonight at 6 and donate anytime at wjffradio.org.
Hello, I'm Michelle Martin. How's the newspaper where you live? Thin? Getting thinner? Publishing a few days a week, if at all? You're not alone. Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat.
It will sell off more of its daily newspapers.
The largest news organization is shrinking.
It's laid off nearly a quarter of its newsroom.
And that makes it harder to keep up with our elected officials and what they're doing. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part by keeping NPR and the station strong with a donation today. And we thank you.
Your gift keeps local news, culture, and NPR funded and freely available to the entire community.
Give what you can to keep it going. It's so important right now. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and our Summer Fun Drive continues at 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. There's a $250 challenge from Roger and Kaneaga Lake, and good news to report that we've heard from Matthew online. Thank you so much for that. And also from Peter online. So now we have just over $100 to go, and I can't reach the bell because it's on the other side. LJ, one of our volunteers, is here. Go ahead. There we go. It's official now. So now about $110 left to go on this challenge. Call us at 845-482-4141 or go to WJFFradio.org. Help us meet this challenge. Help us during our summer fun drive. About 1 in 5 children in Sullivan County live below the poverty line and do not get enough food to eat, to grow, and thrive, according to A Single Bite. They're the nonprofit here in Sullivan County preparing and delivering more than 900 nutritious meals per week to local families in need. But food access across New York State could be an even greater dire need. Last week, President Trump signed into law his big, beautiful bill, which includes significant changes to safety net programs like SNAP and Medicaid, and could reduce nutrition funding by more than $180 billion. Radio Catskills' Kimberly Izar spoke with A Single Bite's executive director, Audrey Garrow, and Real Food Logistics manager, Jennifer Bittetto, about how these federal changes would impact residents locally. And we should note that Radio Catskills spoke to A Single Bite before that mega bill became law officially on Friday.
Why don't we start with hearing just more about the work that you do? Tell me more about A Single Bite and why it's so important in a county like Sullivan County.
Even though we're only 6 years old, having been in this community, really originating with the idea that we could provide nutrition education to young people, helping them to make good choices when they can, but also to think about the difference between real food, processed food, and where their food comes from. During COVID, we, as many other people do, saw food insecurity for the first time, maybe vividly, unfortunately, in Sullivan County. Once you see something like that, especially hungry kids, it's very difficult to unsee it. So we started feeding families with children, and we continue to be a reliable source of food for almost 150 families. As you said, 900 individual servings of healthy food, scratch-made dinners being delivered by volunteers every week to every corner of this county. And we're really proud and grateful for the community support that has enabled us to do that.
Yeah, Jennifer, I'd love to hear more about how you work with local farmers.
We are blessed to have some amazing farmers in this area that are very willing to send over their excess goods to us, specifically after the Calicoon Farmers Market, just to name a few: Heller's, Will-O-Wisp, Lucky Dog. You know, on Monday morning, it's sort of like an angel showed up, and we're able to take what has been gleaned from that market and immediately turn it into as a part of the meal that's going to go out that week. So, you know, it's what's in season. So right now, you know, we have been sending fresh lettuce, you know, fresh salads made from, you know, various greens coming in from market, radishes, turnips, a real showcase of what, you know, people are eating in season right now. We are able to get that translated into these pans that are being delivered to families' homes, which is really, you know, beautiful, beautiful to see.
Right now in the region, we're seeing a housing crisis. We're seeing an affordability crisis. Tell me more about what you're hearing from the communities you serve about why right now is especially a challenging time to put food on the table.
I think just the lack of security in general that's in the air. People feel unsure, unsettled, and it's very difficult to think about going to the grocery store, to the gas station, paying utility bills, paying rent, buying clothes for your kids, all the things that a family has to think about when you're not sure that your public benefit is going to come, what that amount is going to be, that in the months to come, things like that might change. I think it's very difficult for people to prioritize maybe a more nutritious selection mm-hmm. when they can make a choice. The possibility that SNAP benefits, that WIC benefits, that any benefits might be cut. As a not-for-profit that relies primarily on private funding, very little public funding. We know that the private sector cannot fill the gap, what public funding provides for families. What we're trying to do is to stay within our mission, which is to feed and educate local families, especially their children. But to be able to do that with respect, understanding that people, some of our families are in temporary housing, no fault of their own. Other families experience some kind of job change, illness. The factors that lead people to be food insecure are definitely attributable to poverty. And there's generational poverty in this community that is going to be very hard to kind of combat in the short term. And there are a lot of people that are really focused on, as you say, the housing issue and education in this community too. And so we just really feel like if children are going to school and they're not worried about dinner when they get home, and that parents can go to work and not worry necessarily about the grocery bill, you know, and making sure that there's something on the table, that we're doing our part.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the federal shifts that we're seeing at a national level, and then also how that impacts us locally. A number of things. Earlier this year, the USDA cut a $1 billion program that allows schools and food banks to buy food directly from local farmers. We've also heard from several farmers in the region about how the USDA funding cuts have impacted them. They were supposed to get grants that were already approved for distribution, and then it still hasn't come. And then on top of that, another big federal proposal that is on people's radars is President Trump's Big Beautiful Bill, and includes an estimated $230 billion in SNAP cuts over 10 years that would pass a significant amount of those costs onto states. As we're talking about federal cuts, what does that mean for the work that you do?
I think for the work of A Single Bite, and the reason we were founded, was to help improve the health of this county. And everything you just listed will ultimately, whether it's long-term, short-term, affect the health of the people who live here. And that in turn affects the resources required, whether it's our hospital, whether it's the health of individuals who are maintaining our roads, whether it's children's ability to go to school, to learn, to grow, to thrive physically and intellectually, emotionally, I should also mention, in order for them to contribute to the future of this community in a productive way, they need to be healthy. And it's that old adage, we are what we eat. As a community, we are that as well. So in terms of A Single Bite, in our mission to help to elevate the health of the community, everything that's threatened, that is all that funding that's threatened by these changes that are really about the bottom line and not about the individuals who will be ultimately impacted. It's disturbing for A Single Bite. It, I think, also at the same time motivates us to do the best that we can do with the funding that we have, and also to find those partners in the community, whether it's donors, farmers, volunteers, other organizations that we also look to, so that we're being as efficient as we can, so that we're not duplicating efforts. Sullivan County, I believe, has a history of taking care of itself by necessity, but also I think because it's a community that is built on very resourceful people. Mm. It's not an easy place to live, especially through a winter. I think, you know, think about farmers. The growing season is very short. They have to plan really carefully. And I know that Jen's been talking to some farmers about actually planting crops for us. And it's very difficult to do all of that. Those farmers are also, you know, some of them struggling to put food on their own tables, which is ironic. And my prayer is that the human beings in Washington think about the human beings that are at the other end of the decisions that they make.
Yeah, Audrey, you make me think about demographics of the folks who are facing insecurity is really vast. You know, you mentioned how some of the farmers who are growing the food are sometimes the ones who need the food themselves. I'm curious if there's anything else that you want to share about the work that you do and particularly why it's so important right now and as we think about the future of the region.
Well, you know, I think the farming industry and the schools, I mean, they're both very challenged already. You know, it's right. Farming today is it takes a lot of heart and a lot of work and a lot of support from the community and from agencies that are ultimately, you know, providing resources to make this all happen, to bridge the gap between today's society and something like farming. And the schools, I mean, you know, they've been challenged with feeding children properly for some time now, right?
Yeah.
And without these programs, you know, it's making an already challenged obstacle even harder. So, you know, it does actually fuel us at A Single Bite in a big way because we know more than ever that there's help that is needed. With our farm-to-school food pilot that we're doing for next year, it's super exciting that we are going, no matter what, we are going to take the funding we have to create scratch-based food, farm-freshly sourced items into prepared food that we're going to provide to the schools. So to us, it's, you know, we feel like our mission's even stronger right now. And, you know, to support the farmers, to support the kids in school and at home, is just top priority. And, you know, to, like I said, to bridge that gap that is just getting wider.
I've been chatting with Audrey Garrow, Executive Director of A Single Bite, and Jennifer Botetto, A Single Bite's Real Food Logistics Manager. For the last few minutes, Audrey and Jennifer, thank you so, so much for chatting today.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you to reporter Kimberly Izar for bringing us that story. And you can support the great work that Kimberly and everyone here is doing to bring you local news and all the information that you rely on by supporting us now during our fun drive. It's our summer fun drive, and we have a challenge from Roger in Conneaugh Lake, a $250 challenge. We have about $110 to go there on that challenge before the end of Radio Chatskill. In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. So call us now at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. We want to continue to bring you those stories that impact your lives, your neighbors' lives, the community's lives. We can do that with your support. We're listener-supported public radio. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. Donate right now during our summer fun drive. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, science stories with our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, including where nature gets weird, space gets fast, and the earth just won't sit still. It's coming up after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
It's Layla Faldin from NPR's Morning Edition. The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats. This aversion to truth has taken hold as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving reams of disinformation to fill the void. In public radio, we have a responsibility to counteract disinformation. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction. Having a reporter at the school board meeting, at City Hall, that is our resistance to the undermining of a free press. We resist by being there, by providing platforms for people to see themselves reflected and to see difference. We resist by building bridges and by holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Or call us here at 845-482-4141. It's our summer fun drive, and we need your support to continue to bring you the local news, culture, and NPR that you rely on. I'm Tim Bruno. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, and it's time for science stories with our resident science guy, Joe Johnson. This week, he's got some interesting stories about a sneaky bird that lays its eggs in another bird's nest and lets someone else do the parenting, the conniving cowbird, a new interstellar object that's entered our solar system and it's moving fast, and beneath our feet, things are shifting. Literally, Joe explains about some Earth movement in East Africa and what it could mean for the future of the continent. He spoke with our own Jason Dole with Science Stories this week with Joe Johnson.
three interesting stories this week. The first one is, I entitled it, How Do Cowbirds Learn to Be Cowbirds? This is a new study in the journal Animal Behavior about the brown-headed cowbird, Molothrus ader. They actually live in this area, too. They're a really common bird. They're a black bird. They have like a chocolate brown head. And they're what's called obligate brood parasites. They lay their eggs in the nests of other birds and get the other birds, the host parents, to raise them as their own. Feeding for them, you know, feeding them, caring for them, etc. So the question is, how do cowbirds learn to be cowbirds if they're being raised by these other species of birds? They obviously need to do this to carry on the species, right? To mate with their own species. So what happens is the juveniles stay with the host parents for about a month and then they go off on their own. But how do they find other cowbirds? How do they, like I said, how do they learn to be cowbirds? Now, an earlier study from 1995 captured juvenile cowbirds with adult females. They tend to flock together, we think. And they did blood tests on them, and they seemed to show a link between the adults and the juveniles. And what they thought was that the adults would lay the eggs in the nest, the females would lay the eggs in the other bird's nest, and then kind of hang around and wait for them to fledge and then take over the parenting. But a new study shows that there's no genetic link between captured young and adult females. They had a small sample size, about 122 adults and 7 juveniles in Illinois. So they're not hanging around. So how do they learn to recognize their own species? Well, what they found is that the young are very, very attracted to the what they call the chattering, the vocalizations of female cowbirds. And so they find the females, they form a flock, and they hang out with each other. The new study also proposes that the juvenile plumage resembles adult females. And so birds of a feather flock together. They think that they may be attracted to other birds that kind of look like them. And this is really important for them to get together because there's a lot of birds that are really openly aggressive to these cowbirds. Okay, American robins, red-winged blackbirds, red-eyed vireos, which are in this area.
Do they know? Do they remember what these cowbirds get up to and they don't like it?
Evolution does some crazy things. Yeah. But yeah, over time. Blue jays also are very, very aggressive towards cowbirds. And in fact, some birds are known to recognize cowbird eggs if they're laid in their nests and kick them out. Blue jays, for instance, are really, really good at recognizing. Robins are really, really good at recognizing. And one one that's around here is the gray catbird. You can hear them, but they're really hard to see. So it's a really interesting study. You know, how do cowbirds learn to be cowbirds? I thought it was a pretty interesting story this week.
Well, that's pretty cool. Your next story that you got for us is something called Three Eye Atlas. And if you just came up to me and said, have you heard of Three Eye Atlas? I'd figure that was like had to do something about mapping out the psychic realm. But that's not what this is at all.
That's not what this is about. The Three Eye stands for Third Interstellar. This is the third interstellar object ever detected. We know that there's been ones beforehand, and there's probably still some smaller ones that come in from another solar system. They come in from outside our solar system. So, yeah, it's Three Eye Atlas, which is now called C-2025-N1 Atlas. This is from a press release from NASA last week. It was detected by the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System in the Chilean Andes. That's right,
That's good sign.
That's, yes.
That's good work.
Yes. Well, that's what the Atlas form stands from. It was, stands for. It was detected on July 1st, and it was confirmed on July 2nd, and it looks to be an interstellar comet. Okay. It's estimated to be about 20 kilometers across, or about 12 miles in diameter. It's the largest and brightest interstellar object yet. There were two others before that. I don't know if you remember. Oh, I got to pronounce this correctly.
I can't say it. I remember, but I can't say it.
Oumuamua.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, it's a Hawaiian word for messenger from afar arriving first. And this was the first confirmed interstellar object. It was only about 100 meters across, but it was on its way out of the solar system when we detected it. And then in 2019, there was the comet Borisov. And this was really small. It was only about 900 meters across. This new one, like I said, is about 20 kilometers or about 12 miles across. It's got a coma around it, which comets, you know, get, it's the gas and dust around them, and it has a very short tail. So there's a lot of telescopes that are now observing it and more to come. I'm sure they'll bring the James Webb into line, and I'm sure they'll use Hubble to look at it too. There's actually, online observatories where you can see it. I was looking at it the other day. It's just a tiny little dot in the star field that you can see. And by the way, we know it's an interstellar object because it's following what's called a hyperbolic path. It's the shape of the curve of its motion through the solar system.
Right. So if it was from our neighborhood, it wouldn't be following the curve that it's following right now.
Right.
It's got to be from somewhere else.
Right. That tells us that it's just not bound by the sun's gravity. It will be affected by the sun's gravity. It'll change its course a little bit, but it's not coming back. It's just passing through the solar system.
It seems, you know, and as technology advances, we'll probably be seeing more and more of these types of things.
Yes.
But it's not as common as, you know, comets that come from our own. They come from the Oort cloud that's mm-hmm. way out there, yep. but it's part of our solar system.
Right.
But it does make sense that this might happen because we're told that large Jovian-style, gas planets in solar systems like our Jupiter, like Saturn, do a good job of protecting the inner planets by kind of flinging some of these objects away. So this presumably would be something that might have been flung away by a Jovian planet in another
mm-hmm.
system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're really interested in it because of that, because we want to look at the chemistry of it. We want to use spectroscopy to figure out what is this comet made of. Borisov 21, or 2I Borisov, I think I called it 21. It's 2I Borisov for second interstellar. That had a weird chemistry to it. It had a lot of carbon monoxide, which they think makes it come from a red dwarf star solar system. So the chemistry of it is going to be really cool to look at.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And this thing is on its way in right now. Now, presently, it's moving at about 133,000 miles per hour. I looked it up this morning. And it's inside Jupiter's orbit, about 323 million miles from the Earth right now. It'll eventually pass inside Mars's orbit. Not going to hit Mars, not going to hit anything, by the way. And it'll make its closest approach to the sun on October 29th or 30th, right in there somewhere. It'll be about 130 million miles away from the sun, and it'll be moving at about 152,000 miles per hour. That's just crazy numbers, right?
How does that compare? You might not know, but how does that compare to our own local comets?
Oh, comets in our solar system move slower than that.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, it's not going to be visible to the naked eye. It's too small, too far away. Some amateur astronomers may be able to see it with like really big telescopes. You're going to need a 15 or 16 inch telescope to be able to see this thing. It's best viewed in the southern hemisphere. And like I said, there's some online telescopes that are already observing it.
Wow.
And, you can, like I said, you can find those online pretty easy. Lots of observations are going to be made, especially, like I said, especially we're really interested in the chemistry of this thing. So since it's on its way in and it's going to be coming in all summer and into the fall, we're definitely going to be hearing more about, this comet.
And of course now, though, it does whet my appetite for something that it is not, which is a comet that I might be able to see with my eyes or my binoculars.
Nope.
And so now that's going to make me, once we're done talking, start to go searching. Is there anything on the line? Because I'm always keeping an ear out, keeping an eye out for when the next comets might be, because mm-hmm. we've been kind of spoiled in recent years. We've had some good comets, and that makes you want to see another one.
Yeah, there was one last fall. I can't remember the name of it. I was able to observe it, and it was really, really cool.
And now finally, your last story for us, you're taking a look at, some serious tectonic shifts going on in East Africa, and something interesting is being detected in among these.
Yeah, they've seen something that they haven't seen before. This is from the June 25th issue of the journal Nature Geoscience. It was a team led by Swansea University in the UK, and it concerns the Afar region of East Africa, which I had never heard of. I knew it was there, but I never knew the name of it. This is where three rift zones come together. A rift zone is where the Earth is actually moving apart. The continental plates are being pulled apart. There's three plates there, or three rifts there, I should say. The Ethiopian Rift, the Red Sea Rift, which, of course, formed the Red Sea, and the Gulf of Aden Rift, which formed the Gulf of Aden. Now, rift zone is where parts of the Earth's tectonic plates are moving apart. This is how, like, Pangaea broke up and moved the pieces apart to form the continents that we know today. The best one that we know of today is the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. That's the one that everybody knows about out there in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which is slowly widening the Atlantic Ocean by a few centimeters per year. This triple rift zone, though, in the Afar region is a really geologically active area. Lots of multiple volcanoes and earthquakes. And it's not a place I think I would want to live just because of that.
You know, this is a region of the world that when I think of it, I think of the origins of humankind. Mm-hmm. You think about very ancient things, like mm-hmm. not just ancient civilizations of modern humans, which also have a connection in that area, but early hominins, mm-hmm. you know, things that became humans. That this is just purely coincidental, but it is a region of the world that still has like a very old look. So to be talking about, you know, this type of geologic time frame and events that are happening there mm-hmm. Seems aesthetically appropriate, although I'm conflating things scientifically.
Well, you're right. There's a lot of different things going on there. This is where the cradle of mankind apparently started. That's what the fossils tell us. Now, scientists associated with this new study have taken multiple samples from the volcanoes in the area, trying to understand what's going on. They've identified distinct geochemical signatures that repeat across the region. In fact, they've likened them to a barcode. And combined with some pretty advanced computer modeling, they're looking at the structure of the crust and the mantle. The study shows that there's this rhythmic pulsing of plastic rock. The top of the mantle is called the asthenosphere, and asteno means like very weak or not very strong. It's an upper layer, and it's made of rock like near its melting point. It's like plastic rock. And so it can move slowly over time. And, you know, hotter stuff is a little less dense, and so it's rising. And they've detected these pulses that is leading them to understand that there's a big plume in the upper mantle there that's actually pushing these three areas apart. This is going to affect the tectonic plates, causing them to move apart.
Now that they've detected this, what are they going to be watching for?
Well, they're going to be watching for, they've never seen a seafloor develop. You know, the rifting has already created the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and it'll eventually create a new sea as this Ethiopian rift opens up and water from the Indian Ocean comes flooding in. The adjacent East Africa rift zone will open up, and like I said, it'll form a new body of water, a new ocean.
And that's geologic time. So we're talking about over the course of millions of years.
This is
right?
Millions of years. Yeah, wow. This isn't happening next week. Now, running parallel to the Ethiopian Rift is the East African Rift Zone, where millions of years from now, like we said, a section of East Africa will actually rip free, form a new island and a new sea between it and the African continent.
Wow, this is really cool stuff. Joe, yeah. What do you think?
I think it's not going to happen in my lifetime. But it's still cool to understand the process behind its formation. You know, we can see what has happened in the past, and but we've never seen it happen in our lifetime. We've never seen it happen in our time. So it's definitely something that scientists are going to be looking at.
I mean, while we're talking, I just looked up online so I could, you know, see a diagram map of this rift area, and just mm-hmm. it's just with arrows on it to indicate where all the different plates are moving. Mm-hmm. This is shocking. This yeah. is a shocking amount of movement.
Well, you got to remember that this movement is centimeters per year. You know, they say plates move about the same speed as your fingernails grow.
Right.
And so this is something that it's not, like I said, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's definitely happening.
Well, as these science things happen, we're lucky to have Joe Johnson here to tell us about them. Joe, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Jason Dole speaking to Joe Johnson, our resident science guy. Our resident fundraisers are here, too. It's Mimi here with our intern, Zoe. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
It's the first time you've been on air. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what a great time for you to come on here, because you guys got some good news about this challenge.
We do. Yes. We just zoomed right through that challenge.
Yes.
So thank you again to Roger from Jeff for putting that – or Koneonga Lake, I'm sorry, for putting that up. We heard from Matthew, Adam – our good friend Star from Narrowsburg. And Zoe, who did you speak to?
I want to say a really huge thank you to Linda and Bruce from Livingston Manor for their donation in honor of a single bite.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah,
thank
she heard
guys.
That broadcast and was inspired to give. So well, it was great.
And that's what we were saying. Like, we want to, and we do. It's our mission to bring you these stories and this information and get the word out about what's going on. You know, the single bite is one example of all the great work that people in the community are doing. And then when that comes under threat, you need to know about that too, and what they're trying to do and how they're trying to pivot. And we're here to provide that platform to amplify those voices for everybody in the community. There's so many great stories and people and information and connections that we're here
to
bring.
Absolutely. And exactly. It takes all of us to make all this happen. Absolutely. So for those of you that are listening, if you haven't donated yet, 845-482-4141. Zoe may take your call or online at wjffradio.org. And Zoe, do you want to do the honor of ringing that bell?
Oh, yes.
All right. First fun drive break officially in the books.
Oh.
And looks like there's some breaking news coming in, too, from Jill, one of our board members
thank
who's here
Jill.
With some calling. Thank you so much, Jill. Ellen, thank you so much. Oh, my gosh. Ellen, such a generous donation. Favorite programs, Love Shelf's Life with Aaron Hicklin, Mixtape, and On Point, which is coming up next.
Thank you so much, Ellen. We appreciate it.
Well, we have just enough time before we get to On Point to have cultural reporter Valerie Manzi talk with Ursula Hudak, Creative Opportunities Coordinator at the Roxbury Arts Group. They're talking about Artist Promotion 101, a free virtual workshop designed to help artists sharpen their promotional skills.
Good morning, Ursula, and welcome back to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning. Thank you for having me again.
You're here today to talk about Artist Promo 101. Can you tell us what that is?
So Artist Promo 101 is the first of a series of professional development workshops that we're going to be doing for our grant cycle. And it's from a series that I took back in November of last year through Springbird of the Arts, which is a Minnesota-based arts nonprofit. So I learned how to conduct a lot of these professional development workshops in-house, which was really, really handy. And so this is the first of several that we're going to be doing. And it's based around how do artists promote their work? How do you kind of cultivate the language that you use to talk about your work? And how do you get your message out there, really? And we just think that it's kind of a good skill to learn. And it's especially hard, especially in this rural area, to get the word out about your art and to promote yourself. So I'm just looking forward to, you know, helping people with that. We've got a few upcoming workshops after that. We'll have a workshop on grant writing, but we're going to have multiples of these. This one's over Zoom, and then we'll have some that are in person, one at Bushel and one at our sister location, Headwaters in Stamford.
I'm sure you'll have a lot of respondents.
We've already had a lot of interest, and I think it goes to show that there's not a lot of resources in this area for teaching professional development for artists, so we're just happy to offer it.
And what else do you have coming up there at Roxbury Arts Center?
We've got some performances coming up, and, you know, it's always really packed in the summer. And we have multiple camps that are happening, Camp Feathers in a Notebook for kids, and then we also have one Camp Feathers in a Notebook for adults. Last year, we had a memorial show for Ian O'Brien, the local kid who was really active in the community, who sadly passed while he was in Colorado some years back. We had a memorial show to honor his art, and he was really, really invested in art and nature. And we thought that it would be an honor to bring his memory into a camp for kids in the summer to connect nature and artistic practice. And we'll have a local teacher named Andy Hope teaching that. She'll be teaching the kids how to use naturally found pigments to make art. And we're really excited about it. There's both a camp for kids and then a camp for adults.
And when do these camps happen?
Sometime in August, the first few weeks.
Ursula, give us the website so folks can get more information about all the programs available.
Sure. Our website is www.roxburyartsgroup.org. That's arts with an S. And we have a fancy new website for you to look at that has all of our events and programs available right there.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And I wish you a very fruitful summer.
Of course. Thank you so much. And I wish you that, too.
Thank you to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. That's it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening and thanks for donating, and keep doing it if you haven't.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists,
artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
NPR and this station don't just report the news, we explain what it means for you. Because the news is personal, and your support is essential. Donate to this station today, and thank you.
Go to WJFFradio.org.
Or call us at 845-482-4141. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Partly cloudy skies becoming overcast in the afternoon. A stray shower or thunderstorm possible, and isolated thunderstorms during the evening could contain some damaging winds. 81 for the high today, 64 tonight for the low. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.